Les colloques du Collège de France.
So the next speaker is Alexandre Meyrand from the EPFL, the Polytechnic School in Lausanne, Switzerland. And Alexandre is going to tell us about the cooperative assignment of enhancer activity, pattern formation, cell specification using these pseudoembryos. Alexandre.
Hello, everyone. I hope everyone had a nice lunch and you're not falling asleep, or at least that I won't make you fall asleep. I actually started working on this project quite a while after. I used to work with Denis Duboul, and believe it or not, I was not working in gene regulation. I was actually studying cell adhesion and cadherin. But that's not what I'm going to talk to you about today, and I'll explain what I mean by the title here. Although the other speakers have done a tremendous job explaining what enhancers are, how they act, I'll just give you my brief reminder and the type of questions I'm interested in this project. So I'll just switch to the laser pointer because I was instructed to do so. So when you have a gene that is transcribed, that is expressed in a variety of tissue, so-called pleiotropic genes, it's generally assumed that you have specific enhancers that each have their own activities, and this gets somehow integrated into the final pattern of gene expression. And this is really well exemplified in the superb locus that has been presented by several people today of Sonic Hedgehog, where you have many cell-specific enhancers that drives its pleiotropic activity. And so it's highly visible with this ZRS element in the lib. When you delete it, you completely lose Sonic Hedgehog phenotype, Sonic Hedgehog expression, leading to a limb-specific Sonic Hedgehog phenotype. But, and this has been also slightly approached, what happens when a different promoter is in the same regulatory landscape? Do they share the regulatory output that gets that they get from their enhancers, or do they compete with one another? So we've seen from the work of Wendy earlier that the MNX1 gene in the vicinity can hijack some of the enhancers of Sonic Hedgehog, and this is not detrimental, but other cases where this is important and relevant. And so there's this study that I really enjoy, where basically what the authors did is that they studied two heterozygote situations. So they have these HER1 and HER7 genes, which are part of the somitic differentiation, and they created mutants in zebrafish where the same copies or the same allele had both mutations. The fish is perfectly fine. But when you do the same, so you have the same total number of proteins, so you have HER7, HER1, but now on different copies. The two intact ones are on different copies. Now you get phenotypes with deficient segmentation. So you can see by fused vertebrae. And the authors associated this with the ability of the two transcripts to get very well coordinated when the two copies are on the same allele. While if you put the two intact copies on different one, you lose this coordination, and this doesn't work as well. There's also this fantastic study by Fukaya in the lab of Mike Levin, which used this synthetic system where he used the same promoter and placed it in different configuration relative to one enhancer. So in this case, you have the same distance, linear distance, between the enhancers and the two promoters that either drive red PP7 signal or green MS2 signal. And when this is the case, you can see coordinated bursts of transcription between the two promoters. When you now alter the distance, so now you can see the snail promoter is placed much closer to the enhancer, you have a much higher frequency of burst of PP7 in relative to MS2. So clearly there seems to be an impact when you have multiple promoters in the same landscape. So in the lab, we're using mammalian system, and so we were looking for loci that could fit this description of sharing a regulatory landscape. And so we stumbled upon this locus that has been studied in great depth, actually, by a lab in Japan, Yumiko Saga, and I'll present some of her work. But you have these two genes, MESP1 and MESP2. They're located just 17 kbs away. So it's a very short locus. It's not like in the megabase range. It's two or three orders of magnitudes lower than long-range regulation as is typically studied. The regulation is partially shared. You have two waves of expression during mammalian development. You have an early wave right around the time of gastrulation. At the site of the primitive streak, you have MESP1 that gets strongly activated and MESP2 much more weakly. And at later stages during somite formation, you can see that both transcripts are now detected. So you have not completely coordinated. There is a partial sharing of the landscape, or at least of the pattern of expression. And in terms of enhancers, so far only two enhancers have been identified. One that is really in the proximity, just 300 base pair upstream of the MESP2 coding sequence, or transcriptional start site, I should say, and this intergenic element, which has been more associated with MESP1 transcription. And this is roughly 4 kb. So these are minuscule distances. So at those levels, linear distances is likely to also play a role rather than only the 3D one. And so these are the activities of the enhancer. The intergenic one is active early and at late stages, whereas this P2 element is active only at late stages in the somites. So now, what do these genes do? Are they important for development? So if you knock both of MESP1 and MESP2, the mouse don't gastrulate. They are not able to progress past the gastrulation state. You have an accumulation of mesodermal cells at the site of the primitive streak. Now, if you remove just MESP2, what you have is you have a fusion of the vertebras, so strong somitic phenotypes. But if you do something, so this was done by Yumiko Saga in 98, what she did is that she integrated the MESP1 coding sequence right at the location where MESP2 should be. And when you do that, you completely rescue the phenotype. So this means this phenotype is not due to difference in the protein sequence, but from the regulation. You need a MESP gene, regardless which one, at that location. And similarly, when you do a knockout for MESP1, you can see, or it's not as easy to see in those bright field images unless you are a heart development expert, but there is barely any phenotypes in cardiac development here. But you can see that MESP2 gets upregulated slightly at early during gastrulation. But if you do a different construct, and this is how the mutant was initially studied, so there was an insertion of a PGK-NEO cassette instead of the coding sequence of MESP1. And when you do that, this prevents the ectopic or induced expression of MESP2, and this leads to a cardiac phenotype. So clearly the regulation for these genes is hugely important into what phenotypical outcome you get. And so now, getting into the project, this is the true star of the show. This is Dominique. PhD student have been supervising on this project, and she's been absolutely fantastic, as you'll see. So we turned to a model system that mimic mammalian embryogenesis to approach this locus. We've used gastroloids. So the lab of Denis has used them extensively to study Hox collinear expression, where they've been proven to be extremely useful because you can control exactly when the timing of all the events. You don't have the issues of stage differences that you would get in a natural embryos. And they're very good at mimicking the posterior part of an embryo, so they can have Hox collinear expression. And also, if you slightly change the protocol, you can get these beautiful stripes of somites. So you can recapitulate trunk development using mouse gastroloids. And what about the two genes that we're interested in? So that's the first thing Dominique did, is that she looked at the expression of MESP1 and MESP2. And so she used HCR here, hybridization chain reaction, to assess the expression of MESP1 in green and MESP2 in red. And I'm sorry, the color here are inverted. But you can see that early on, at 78 hours, the absolute timing is not critically relevant here for the understanding, but I will refer frequently to the early steps and the late stage of MESP1 and 2 expression. And you can see that early on we only have MESP1 expression, while at later stages we have MESP2. And you can see that the patterns don't fully overlap. You have MESP1 that is expressed in a slightly broader domain, and this is something that we see as well when we look at it in an embryo. In terms of which tissue it is, it corresponds to exactly the same tissues as you would see in the embryo. So the anterior primitive streak regions express MESP1 but not MESP2, and the somitic tissue express both MESP1 and MESP2. So the behavior is very similar to what we would get in an embryo. So then what Dominique wanted to do is to start taking advantage of the gastroid system. It's a system that grows outside the uterus, so you can image it. And so she decided to generate knock-in lines, dual reporter knock-in line, with a GFP in the MESP1 gene and an MCHERRY in the MESP2. And using that, she was able to reproduce the early expression of MESP1 without MESP2, the shared expression of both MESP1 and MESP2. However, at later stages, at 120 hours, we can see that the signal extend much more extensively than the mRNA. And this is due to the stability of the fluorescent proteins. Although we had a destabilization domain, it remains too stable for the dynamic system that we're using here. But still, it's very good in order to study the emergence of these patterns. And you can see in these light sheet movies that we've done in collaboration with Andy Oates at EPFL, where you can see the emergence of first, and it will come back first, disorganized MESP1 as seen by the GFP signal, and then MESP2 turns on, and you can see with a really fine resolution the dynamic of this system. So having this dynamic of really precise timing, Dominique wanted to understand, how does this compare to the chromatin landscape? Can we get the dynamic of the landscape? And so she turned to ATAC-seq to look at chromatin accessibility. And these intergenic and P2 are the two elements that were known. But there was one more that was also quite obvious for the signal that showed a quite different dynamic with much higher accessibility early on, and this decreased with time. While the other two show minor activity at early stage, and this is temporarily accessible, while this one is more of a late element. So there were additional elements, CTCF site that I just annotated here, I'm not showing the chip, other putative elements. And so what she did is she really did a heroic effort. She deleted them one by one. So that's 12 deletions. She did that during her first 6 months of PhD. 11 deletions, analyzed each of them at every time point of gastroid development. And after doing all this, we wanted to be extensive and identify all the potential elements that could be involved in the regulation of this locus. And we ended up with just three, the two known, the intergenic and this P2 element, and this early one. And those are the ones I will show you now. And we've analyzed them in order to try to get really the cell type specific response after losing each of these enhancers. So we analyzed different lines, either single enhancer deletions or combined, and I will present them in that order. At three time points, at 78 hours, 96 hours, and 120 hours, or here you can see the different cell identities that you can find. So this is a UMAP representation of the single cell RNA-seq data, where each dot corresponds to one cell and the color corresponds to the color coding annotated here. But what's important is, in our case, the expression of these genes. And so I'd like you to focus on the different areas I've circled. And these correspond to the three cell types and timing at which MESP1 and MESP2 are expressed. So you can see early on at 78 hours here, we have in this population expression of MESP1 but not MESP2. Then at around 96, we have expression here in this presomitic mesoderm and here in those differentiating somites. So in the somites, you can see the expression is shared. and in the anterior primitive streak, it's only MSP1. So what happens when now we delete the early enhancer, the one we first identified, the new enhancer that we didn't know, we can see that now we've lost. So this is a comparison of it's a pseudo bulk analysis. So in the population of cells corresponding to this identity, which you can see here, we have about 10% remaining of the initial level of MSP1. However, if you go later on, you can see now here in this population, we have 35%. If you go at the more differentiating state, you have 60%. You have some but weak impact on MSP2 after deleting these enhancers. But you can see that the dependency of these enhancers decreases with time. When you take at this other one, this intergenic element, you can see the exact reverse. Early on, we lose some expression of MSP1, but we still have about 56% of the expression. And as differentiation goes on, you can see that this dependency increases with, at the latest time point, only 20% of MSP1 level remains. And finally, when you delete the P2 element, you can see that for MSP2, so I forgot to mention, but there's barely any effect on the MSP2 expression following the deletion of this element. So these two elements are mostly involved in the regulation of MSP1 and do not too much on MSP2 expression. When you remove the P2 element, now you completely abolish MSP2 expression. And actually, we were a bit surprised and we saw the reverse of what we were expecting. We saw an increase of MSP1 expression. And I'll come back to that a bit later. Now, in terms of combination, and in order not to show you all the different combinations, I'll just focus on this one. When we now combine these early and intergenic elements deletions, you can see that we lose completely any MSP1 transcription. So we don't get some or an additive effect. We have a full-on loss. So those enhancers are completely required for the expression of MSP1. And we have a slight but not major impact on MSP2 transcription. And so we see the same regardless of which combination we do. And when we now look at, does it matter? Because I've shown you that when you delete the gene in the mouse, you can get a rescue from the other MSP2 when you delete MSP1, or slightly from MSP1 as well when it's expressed in the same area. So what happens now phenotypically when you delete enhancers? And so if you look at cell identity here in two single enhancer deletions, you can see that not much is visible. So you remove the early elements, this population is fine, this population is fine. Most of the relevant populations don't show drastic phenotypes. But if you combine them together, now you can see that this lineage, which actually corresponds to the cardiac lineage, gets depleted. When you now focus on these two intergenic and P2 elements, you don't see much individually, maybe slight effect in the deletion of the P2. But when you put them together, what you can see here is that this population, this cluster here, which is the anterior presomitic mesoderm, is actually completely gone. And instead, the cells follow, you're not supposed to really drive conclusions from the position of the UMAP, so you'll see the functional validation in the next slides. But you can see that the cells take out a different path. And so this is what drove us also to analyze the triple deletion now. When you remove all the enhancers, you can see that the cardiac lineage is completely gone, and the trajectory taken in the somatic path is also completely shifted. So you have an additive phenotypical effect of these enhancer deletion. And so Dominique wanted to validate now what these phenotypes that she's observed, because these are in vitro systems, there can be some variability derived from them. So she decided to look at somatic differentiation. And I mentioned at the start that you can do this little trick to the protocol. You add extracellular matrix and they start to form these stripes of somites. So this is what Dominique did here. This is the control cell line. And you can see the stripes of UNCUTX and TBX18, which marks the compartment of the somites. And you can see the MSP2 expression right here. When you now remove the P2 element, you can see we still have cells expressing TBX18, we still have cells expressing UNCUTX, but their patterning is completely messed up. And when you now look at the situation when you delete both of the two late enhancers, so the intergenic that controls MESP1, the P2 that controls MESP2, you completely lose the TBX18. So it's not just the patterning, differentiation as well is impaired. And so now if we take a step back and we try to summarize a bit what's going on here, we have the early enhancer that mostly act on MESP1, the intergenic enhancer that mostly act as well on MESP1 but at a different stage, and the P2 enhancer that has an activating role for MESP2, but actually its deletion leads to activation of MESP1. So how do we interpret all of this? How do we generate this specificity? And you have to remember, this is a very short locus. It's 17 kb. So why don't you get a huge transcriptional mess where everything gets activated? And so the answer is we still don't know, as you'll see. But what we do know is that Dominic tried to see if these insulation between enhancers and promoter could be derived from CTCF binding sites. So she went on, and you have three CTCF binding sites, the B and the C facing towards the right. MESP2 here is cut off, but it's here. Another site here that faces on the other way around. Regardless of which CTCF sites we removed, there was no transcriptional changes. So at least after deletion of single CTCF sites, it looks like this is not participating to the insulation of these genes. I can't exclude that multiple deletions would lead to an effect. But then the other approach Dominique took is that she generated some inversion to try to impact the distances between enhancers and the target promoters. So for example, in this one, the region in yellow is inverted, and you can see now MESP1 is located on the outside. This early enhancer is located in the intergenic region, so you have all the enhancers basically now that are placed between the two genes. Or she did another one, where now the full region that contains the MESP1 enhancer shifted, and so this early element is now very as close of MESP1 than MESP2. And finally, the last one that she did is that in this very large deletion, MESP2 is actually brought in the vicinity of the early enhancer. And so the whole point, and that's the reason I didn't show step by step each of the results, is that we detect some minor changes, and this is a log scale, so these are still quite low level. But in red, you have the MESP2 level, in green, you have the MESP1. The light is always the control, the dark color is the mutant. But regardless what she did, there was no major shift. At 78 hours, MESP1 is always the most highly expressed. She could never obtain a situation where you replace the behavior of one gene for the other. However, what Dominique noticed is that I mentioned at the start that she generated some reporter lines. And so here you have a MESP1 mCherry reporter line compared to the MESP1 mCherry reporter line. So those are two lines. So you can see that MESP2 mCherry drives slightly higher level of expression. But she took this MESP1 mCherry, and what she did is she now deleted the promoter from MESP2. And so when you do this, you can see the increased expression of the reporter for MESP1. So in absence of the MESP2 promoter, you increase MESP1. But in this context, the P2 element, which, if you remember, we still don't fully understand what it does, because in some cases, when you delete it, you have an activation of MESP1, and I don't have the answer to that. But what we can see is that after she took the same line and she obtained a deletion where she as well deleted both the P2 element and the MESP2 promoter. And so when she does this, you can see that we now almost go back to the original MESP1 level. So this gained expression suggests that in this context, the P2 element is able to act as an activator for MESP1, since when you remove it, you revert it back to the original level. So with this, I'd like to give some take-home messages. So Dominique performed a systematic dissection of this simple but not so simple regulatory landscape. She could show, using single-cell RNA-seq of enhancer deletions, that MESP enhancer can act synergistically, where the effect is of combined deletion is more important than the individual effects of each enhancers. The enhancers show clear promoter preferences, but this is not driven by the organization of the locus or CTCF. And she could also observe strong phenotype on sulfate specification following combined enhancer deletion. And finally, the last experiment suggests that promoters can segregate enhancer activity, thereby insulating their neighbors. And so in terms of future directions that we'd like to take, there's many. So one obvious experiment would be to switch the promoter sequences to see whether indeed by altering the sequence and gaining twice the same enhancer, would they now be equivalent in terms of which enhancers they would favor. Or another one is to take advantage of the triple deletion, similarly to what was presented this morning on the beta globin locus, take this empty locus now that is devoid of any enhancers and place back either one enhancers or two enhancers or three, and using either Sleeping Beauty or transposon system, changing the location of the enhancers and seeing the output of how each of the promoters get activated. But there's many possibilities of things that I would like to do in the long term on this. And so with this, I'd like to thank Denis for the invitation today and also for hosting this research at EPFL. Lucille, bioinformatician, and Catherine, who helped with generating some of the lines that I actually didn't show in this presentation. Yulia for the imaging of the HCR, all the funding, but of course the star of the show, Dominique, who led this work throughout. And with this, I'll take any questions.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.